very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. First, we're going to go to JobSpot with Darren Kelly. Darren, what have you got?
Thank you very much, John. We've got two in total, starting off with SolGrid, a solar PV company in Loughrea, has an opening for solar PV installers, apprentice electrician, lead administrator and marketing executive. CVs to hr@solgrid.ie. Visit solgrid.ie/jobs or call 091-335-335 for more information. And Proverum, a startup medical device company, is looking to hire a permanent manufacturing technician. Apply with your CV to hr@proverummedical.com. And if you need any phone numbers or email addresses, please call our reception on 091-770-077. Search #GalwayJobs on social media or go to goibfm.ie/jobspot.
Thanks indeed, Darren, and very good morning. You're welcome back into today's programme. If you want to get text and WhatsApp into us, you can do on our number. That's 086-3833-553. I'm delighted to say I'm joined in studio for financial advice with Dave McCarthy of McCarthy & Associates. Dave, good morning. You're welcome into us.
Many thanks, John.
You want to do a clarification first, Mr. McCarthy?
Yes, I do. I got a rush of blood to the head last week when I was talking about dormant accounts. For some reason, it dawned on me afterwards, I said an account goes dormant after 7 years. It is, of course, 15 years.
Okay.
So I just want to clarify that.
There would be a lot of money if it was 7 years in the dormant accounts.
I'd be surprised how much money there would be in there anyway. But yeah. Anyway, we covered that issue last week, so we won't go into it again.
Brilliant. Now, evidence proves that investors who rely on media opinion to guide them or who worry excessively about world events will ultimately be losers. This issue.
Well, it's got to do with the fact that, and I can understand why this happens, people think that maybe financial markets and maybe the value of their pensions. And that's another issue. I mean, why do financial markets matter to all of us? People might say, I don't have investments and I don't have this and I don't have that. Most people have some form of pension, maybe through their employer and that. And obviously, that money is invested usually in financial markets. So it does matter to you. But going back to the issue at hand here, there will always be world events. There will always be wars. There will always be political events. They have a temporary effect on financial markets. But, you know, financial markets are very selfish, is a very selfish place, and they look at fundamentals for moving on in the future in terms of growth. So what I would just say is, and what this point is, that if you're going to rely or take into account world events to such an extent, you'd be frozen in time. You know, you think recently we've had COVID, we've had the war in Ukraine, now with gas, all these things, and the world's financial markets, stock markets are record highs. So that proves the point. Don't take on board, to an extreme extent, world events.
Okay. Now, we want to also look at a topic, how to access a pension early.
Yes, this is a way that somebody can access a pension early once they reach the age of 50 and they have a pension built up with a previous employer. Usually when you leave employment, you're given options as to what you can do with that money. And very often people move it into a thing called a retirement bond, and then they can withdraw the tax-free lump sum from that at any stage over 50. Whilst it's a great option to have, it's not something I recommend at all. You shouldn't be trying to access your pension early, before age 65, because you need to let that grow for your future. I would only do that if you were in pretty dire financial need, that you needed a 25% tax-free lump sum out of it, but it's not something you should, a decision you should take lightly. But that's how you can access a pension early. If you're over 50 from a previous employer and you move it into a thing called a retirement bond, you can access it then, but I do not recommend that you do that.
Okay. Now another issue, risk. Take it or expect to make only a small return on your investment.
Yeah, I mean, obviously people don't like to take risk if they don't have to. I think we would all love a situation where you don't take any risk and you get guaranteed return while you're living in Ausland, if you think that. It doesn't happen, right? So you have to take some form of risk. And, you know, it is a good thing to take risk. It's not something you should be afraid of. It depends on the type of investment that you're going into and understanding what the risk is attached to that and how it's invested. But don't be fearful of risk. If you want to get a return, you have to take some sort of risk. If you're going to take no risk and you're going to get full capital protection, well, then you have to have an expectation for a much lower level of return. So all I'm just saying there is don't be fearful of risk.
A calculated risk, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. That's the right description. Calculated risk. I'm not talking that you should be looking to invest in, you know, wildcat oil wells in Indonesia or something like that. So you don't have to go off the scale altogether.
Okay, another question we have in. I have money on deposit in England since I lived there. I'm wondering, should I bring it back to Ireland and reinvest it here?
Well, I think that probably would make sense that you would bring it back to where you're domiciled, in other words, where you're living. Having it in the UK doesn't really make a lot of sense. And then question, next question would be, what about the exchange rate? Look, you're never going to get the exchange rate right. Okay, that's all I will say to that person. You know, it is what it is. If you're trying to play the exchange rates, you could be frozen in time and maybe waiting for it to achieve a certain level before you bring it back, and you could be having this conversation in 2 years' time. Bring it back here and make it productive, because sitting over there, I get the feeling this is on deposit, which it is. You could make a lot more out of that money if you bring it back here and reinvest it in some sort of an investment.
Okay. Another question. I am an only child, and when my father dies, I will inherit his estate. However, it is likely that there will be an inheritance tax liability, as the only asset is property and is valued above the tax-free threshold of €335,000. If I do not have the resources to pay, what will occur?
Yeah, very serious question, and something that a lot of people are encountering when they inherit from a parent. Obviously, from the tone of this question, I take it that this person is not living in the house with their father. And if he was living in the house with the father, the issue of inheritance tax may not apply, but there are qualifications that you need to achieve with the revenue on that. And that's not the question here. I won't go into it now. All I would say, if you were living in the house, well, then you just need to look up the revenue website to see what the conditions are so that you don't pay inheritance tax. But yes, the problem here is that you probably will have to sell the property unless you can raise a loan on the property to meet the inheritance tax liability. And this is unfortunate because, you know, sometimes people, even though they're not living in the house, it's a family home and they might have an emotional attachment, and they certainly don't like the idea of being forced to sell it. And why have they been forced to sell it? They've been forced to sell it because the thresholds are so low for inheritance tax. 335,000 might sound like a lot of money, but when you take the value of houses now, and you've got one person as the sole inheritor, it's not that high. And successive governments in recent years have not raised the threshold. So I don't think it's right that somebody should be forced into the situation of having to sell a house at that level. But unfortunately, you either raise some borrowing on the house to pay the inheritance tax, or you unfortunately will have to sell it.
Okay. Another question coming into us. I need to take out a life policy, and I do not know the difference between a term policy and whole of life. Can you explain what the difference is and cost implications?
Okay. A term policy is, as the name might suggest, is for a particular period of time. So you take out a policy today for 100,000. It's for 20 years. You pay €15 a month premium, whatever it is, and that's it. The premium never changes, it can't go up, it doesn't go down, the cover never changes, and the term never changes. And when you get to the end of the 20 years, hopefully you haven't made a claim, because if you had made a claim, you've died. So once you get to the end of it, that's it, the policy expires. Whole of life is a different concept and a different structure. As the name might suggest, it's for your entire lifetime. So the problem with whole of life policies is, unlike the term policy, the premium is not guaranteed. It gets higher as you get older, much older, once you kind of reach your late 50s onwards. So sometimes people get a bit of a shock and find out, this policy has gone from costing me €50 a month to €120 a month or whatever it is, because I'm much older, right? I would suggest to people to stay away from whole of life policies. Take a policy out for a term that you think you'll be comfortable with, up to your mid-60s usually. And beyond that, most people, John, don't really need life cover. You know, their circumstances are such, they're much older, their family have grown up and all that, they may not need life cover. So take out a term policy. It's cheaper, and what you see is what you get.
Okay. Another question. I have recently become a landlord as I moved from the house I lived to into a house with my husband, and we recently got married. Are there issues I may need to be aware of with a rental property?
Yeah, there are. I mean, outside of maybe the obvious ones in terms of registering the property with the Rental Tenancies Board and the tax issues, there are a few other ones that people mightn't think of that crop up. One is, do you have life cover on the mortgage for that house if you have a mortgage on it? And why do I say that? Sometimes people might say that was a kind of a silly question. If you bought the property with, say, back in the day, and you had originally maybe used it as a rental property, you may not have been required to take life cover from the bank that you were dealing with. Having said that, most banks do require life cover, and the period of time I'm talking about would have been back in the Celtic Tiger era, where they were lax about life cover on non-family homes. The second one is house insurance, very important, and probably more important than the first one. It's important that you have cover on the house as a landlord, and that you tell the insurance company you're no longer residing in it, and you need to tell them it's let and that you have tenants in there, otherwise you could have an invalidated claim if you don't. And then the other one that you might think of is your tenants are not covered under your house insurance. If they want to cover their property, they have to take out their own cover for the contents that they have. I just want to cover you, this person, in case, God forbid, they have a kind of a liability issue from some tenant who takes a case if they're not covered. So there are a couple of unusual ones that you mightn't think of.
I've just one text in from our listeners, Dave. What does Dave McCarthy think of investing pension lump sum in government bonds?
There's nothing wrong with government bonds. It depends on how you're going to access it, because you need to access your whatever pension structure you have. I'm not sure what that person obviously has. Is it, are they in retirement and they've got an ARF, or are you somebody who is a retirement bond? The problem is that any sort of bonds, government, and I'm talking about government bonds, are going to produce a much lower return than what you might get otherwise. There are a variety of other options that person can use to access, which are low risk, by the way. You know, I mentioned earlier about taking risk, but you can also go the route of taking a low risk option, and sometimes with capital protection attached to it. So I would just say to that person, nothing wrong with it, but you know, there are more attractive options out there.
Brilliant. So before I let you go, are you St. Patrick's Daying in Galway?
Well, I'm St. Patrick's Daying in Galway, but I end up getting up too much. I'm not really a St. Patrick's Day person for some reason. I don't know why. Myself and St. Patrick's, the best actually St. Patrick's Day I ever had was when I wasn't in Galway, and I happened to find myself in a remote spot in Ontario in Canada.
Oh.
Yeah, and I was the only Irish person there, so you can imagine how unique I was. I was a bit of a novelty.
Yeah. Dave McCarthy of McCarthy Associates, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks, and you'll be back with Keith at the same time again next Wednesday. But thank you for joining us on Galway Talks. Still to come on the programme today, we have Ask the Dentist with Dr. Brian Delgado, and also a lovely feature on History Talks. University of Galway launches an online archive of historical Irish immigrant letters from America. All that plus lots more coming up between now and 12 midday. A very good morning to you.
Ask the Dentist, brought to you by Gate Dental Clinic. Let's keep Galway smiling. Don't wait. Call the Gate on 547-592.
And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. Delighted to say I'm joined in studio by Dr. Brian Delgado of the Gate Dental Clinic for Ask the Dentist. Brian, good morning.
Good morning.
We're looking at bad breath today, Dr. Brian, because it's a big issue for a lot of people.
It is a big issue for a lot of people, and actually it's a sensitive issue as well. A lot of people might experience it, and one, they don't know that they're experiencing it, and because they're not told by anyone. Oh, it's a kind of sensitive issue, like I said, and they don't really want to address it.
What causes it?
There's a few causes, which springs to mind. I mean, normally, I tend to divide it in the sense it's either coming from the oral cavity, the mouth area, or it's coming from the stomach. And then within those, I mean, there's different causes of it. For example, like, tooth decay can cause it. Gum disease can cause it in the oral cavity. Dry mouth can cause that, and we've all experienced that waking up morning with a dry mouth, and it's that morning breath that we all kind of know about. other medical issues can cause it. If it's coming from the stomach, things like acid reflux could be causing that as well. So there is a variety, and I don't want to really go much into to the medical issues, but I'll stick more to what the dental issues that can cause it.
Yeah. And in terms of one maybe preventing it, obviously stomach issues wouldn't be your forte, but in terms of the mouth and how you as a dentist can advise people to best prevent developing bad breath.
So one of the, if someone is experiencing bad breath, I mean, the best thing is obviously is a visit to the dentist. I mean, and to see if there is anything causing it that is obvious. A simple food trapping between two teeth, for example, food can stay there, a little bit of food stuck in there for a while can give rise to that bad breath. You could have a small cavity in a tooth. Impacted wisdom teeth tend to cause a lot of food trapping, and that can cause bad breath as well. Dry mouth, which is very related as well to the dental world, and that can cause it too. You know, mouthwashes, I mean, chewing gum, mints, things like that help, but it's not really getting to the root cause of the problem. So the best thing is to see where the actual cause of this bad breath is.
Okay. And then in terms of treatment then?
So if there is anything obvious, like say, for example, like a cavity or impacted teeth, gum disease, then you're going to need a specific treatment for those. Mouthwashes, like I said, help the general bad breath, but it kinds of masking the underlying problem if there is one.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of when people do go into their dentist to deal with this, is it important, I suppose, to go regularly and to get your teeth cleaned if it is that food and buildup of plaque that is the problem?
Absolutely, because I mean, plaque, I mean, consists of millions of bacteria, microscopic bacteria. And in the mouth, we generally get two types of bacteria, aerobic and anaerobic. So the anaerobic bacteria are the foul-smelling bacteria, and that's the ones that live under the gum. So if there is plaque, if there is food trapped under the gum, those bacteria kind of proliferate, and then you get this consequence of them, which is that foul-smelling odour, which is actually coming from the bacteria itself.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of dental hygiene practices would you recommend for people who, maybe okay, they've gone to their dentist, they've got their clean, got their diagnosis, etc. Do they need to have an electric toothbrush or regular flossing? The general advice we always give, is that the best?
Yeah, that would be the best. I mean, electric toothbrushes really have moved on quite a lot, and really they are really very good at keeping teeth clean compared to a manual brush. There's always the thought of like you can actually do the same kind of level of cleaning with a manual brush than you can with an electric. But what I find is with most of my patients that are on an electric toothbrush, their hygiene is a lot better.
Yeah, and flossing as well, very important.
Flossing is very important because the brush only goes both sides of the teeth, but it doesn't really get in between the teeth. So flossing, there's no alternative. You know, the electric toothbrush is not an alternative to flossing. I mean, there's something out there, has been there out for years now, which is called a water pick flosser, which is just like a water jet. Not a complete substitute to flossing, but if someone is not going to floss, then I would say, look, then use the Waterpik flosser, because, I mean, it's surprising how much food comes out when, after you've brushed, if you use this Waterpik flosser, how much food is still coming out just after you've brushed. And that's only because the Waterpik flosser is actually getting in between the teeth.
Yeah.
So the brush has actually missed all those areas.
What's the downside to them and ordinary flossing, or what do they lack that an ordinary floss will get?
So the floss is actually that manual sensation of, you can actually get a little bit of more feeling with the floss. So you actually feel if there's something catching. You won't get it with a water flosser. So the water flosser, although it's very good and it's very quick, it's messy. Kids love it because it's messy and it creates a big mess for mummy and daddy to have to clean the bathroom afterwards. But the regular flossing gets to places that the Waterpik flosser wouldn't get to. So you can add it to the dental hygiene regime, really.
Mm. Final one, just if someone is suffering from bad breath, as you mentioned, they might not know it. What's the best way of testing yourself and then if deciding and going into your dentist then?
So normally I find, I mean, and to be honest, I don't get many patients coming in and actually saying, look, I have bad breath. But I mean, you do get a few. I mean, and it's normally been told by a partner, by a family member. Because say, for example, I mean, no one in the office is going to tell someone else, well, I think you've got a bit of bad breath there. Because it comes across as a little bit rude. But actually, that person might be experiencing it and he knows nothing about it.
Yeah, definitely. So, Dr. Brian Delgado, if people want to get more information, where's the best place of doing that?
Gate Clinic. We'd be happy to advise anyone that's got, I mean, our receptionists, even nurses are very good. You don't even have to come to the dentist if you actually have any query like that. So we'd be more than willing to offer advice to anybody.
Brilliant. Dr. Brian Delgado, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thank you very much.
See you again very shortly. Dr. Brian Delgado joining us there for Ask the Dentist.
Ask the Dentist, brought to you by Gate Dental Clinic. Let's keep Galway smiling. Don't wait. Call the Gate on 547-592.
And my thanks to Dr. Brian Delgado for joining us there. Still to come on the programme today, we have History Talks, and today is the turn of Professors Daniel Carey and Brendan McSivna, because they're talking to us all about the University of Galway launching this online archive of historical Irish immigrant letters from America. Very interesting. That's coming up next. And a very good morning to you. Welcome back into today's programme. Now, I'm delighted to say I'm joined on History Talks by Professors Daniel Carey and Brendan McSivna. Gentlemen, you're both very welcome onto the programme today. And it's all to do with the University of Galway launching this online archive of historical Irish immigrant letters from America. Professor Brendan McSivna, I might start with you first. Give us the background of this first.
The university in 2021 received a remarkable gift from the American-born historian Kirby Miller. Kirby is the foremost historian of Ireland in the 19th century, 18th and 19th century, and Irish migration to North America. And he, in working towards a major book that was published in 1985 called Emigrants and Exiles, he had read a voluminous amount of emigrant letters, emigrant memoirs composed by Irish people from the late 17th century through the 20th, because he wanted to get the voice and the experience of ordinary people. And he had reckoned he'd 5,000 such items read when he published his Pulitzer-nominated book in the mid-80s. He has continued to collect such materials up to the present. So he collected materials, transcribed them, in libraries and archives. He also placed notices in newspapers asking people to send him material, which he then copied and transcribed and returned to them. So we have a remarkable archive. It was gifted to the university on the understanding the university would make it available. That we have done. And what the university is also doing is it is continuing the work of Kirby Miller by appealing for more people, for people to add more material to it. So if anybody has emigrant letters, emigrant memoirs, letters from North America, you know, do get in touch with us. We'd be interested in hearing from you.
It's a vast collection.
Vast.
And it dates back, give us the time period where these letters go from.
They come from the late 17th century through to the latter half of the 20th.
Wow.
So it is a major collection. The bulk of the material, there are peaks in different moments, but the bulk of material is in the latter half of the mid to late 19th century. But you get peaks in the wake of the 1798 rising, when there was a big outflow of Presbyterians from the north. Massive outflow, particularly from the west of Ireland, in the years of the famine and after. And emigration has defined our experience, particularly in the west of Ireland, for a very, very long time. It's only in the last, what is it, quarter century, that we you know, emigration hasn't been part of the experience of communities across the west of Ireland.
What are some of the gems you've uncovered in this collection?
Gems, there's no shortage, Dan.
Yeah, there's some wonderful letters, and the great thing about it is you hear people's voices, the distinctive way that they express themselves, and sometimes it's over slightly petty matters, sometimes it's more significant, but you often find that people are commenting on loss. For example, one writer in Pittsburgh is writing in 1845, Anne Waters, and she responds to a letter that had conveyed the sad news of the loss of her father. She said, "Alas, alas, our father, my dear, dear father is no more. As soon as I caught the glance of the letter, I screamed out, 'My father is dead.'"
Yeah.
So the emotional register is there, and very painful sense of loss when the distance is so profound.
Because someone from American heritage, yourself, Daniel, there was a longing for back home. And in those days, this was the form of connecting back home, letters.
Yes, absolutely. This is the mode of communication. And when people left, they assumed they would never see their loved ones again. So the sense of loss is very profound. And regular communication, what you find in the letters is that people want to hear, what's the latest, has so-and-so married, has so-and-so moved away? The immigration patterns where people would often follow one another, but others went to England, others went to Australia. So they're trying to maintain that sense of family. And as you say, it's a very profound sense of wishing to get back. So there's an emotional return, even if there's not a literal one.
Yeah. Is there much of a Galway footprint among these letters?
There is a Galway footprint among the letters. There's a Mayo footprint, there's a Clare footprint. But what you would notice is that in terms of the volume of people that left the country, that the West is underrepresented in the collection. So your listeners are people who we'd be appealing to get in touch with us if they do have letters that were sent from North America to Ireland at any time, that we'd be interested in getting copies of them, adding them to the collection, any memoirs that were written, people writing the short biographies or whatever. So we need material from the West of Ireland. Mm. What we're particularly interested in that context too is material in Irish and material from Irish-speaking districts. So yeah. Gaeltacht letters, whether be they in Irish or English, and letters in Irish alone.
I think it's very important to preserve this type of work, and I know you have digitised it as well.
That's right. I mean, that's when it becomes a very powerful tool, because you can make it more widely available. People can come to the archive itself and they can see all the research materials that Kirby Miller accumulated when he was starting to identify people and figure out the family connections. But actually online, you can get access to the letters immediately. You can put in search terms. You can find out family names, districts, townlands, particular topics that you're interested in. If you're interested in coal miners, if you have a family connection, if you're interested in economic history, the way that people sent money back and forth. You were asking about Galway, and I thought I'd give you one example. This is a letter from 1848, where George Crosby is writing to his mother in Crockwell, County Galway. And he says, any person that writes to you and don't send you money, never write to them. So he was pretty strict about that. He enclosed £6, with a very, £6 sterling, a very substantial amount of money, and said, a banker in Loughrea is sure to cash it for you. Signed, your obedient son. So there's both the material fact of life and a way that families in famine times, in this case, were supported through migration and through people doing their best to make good in America.
Yeah, and understandably so, the collection is rich in that post-famine period from 1850 to 1950, when people flocked out of the country in their droves and continued up until nearly the present day as well. But what sort of things do we see there? Is there much of the political landscape changing? Because I know the Fenians had a big involvement in America as well.
Certainly you do get political opinions being given. You get references to the land war. You get references to political events such as the 1916 Rising, the Tan War, and so on. But you also get material on American politics, like the American Civil War, major events in America. And when we have this collection fully uploaded, we were uploading it in a series of tranches. And when we fully operationalize the character recognition capacity, that will mean that you'll be able to put in something like coal mining, and every letter that concerns coal mining will come up, or Abraham Lincoln. Every letter that mentions Abraham Lincoln or Padraig Pearce or 1916 Rising or violence or whatever. So it'll be a very, very powerful tool for professional researchers, but of massive interest to genealogists and family historians, and of interest too, I think, to people in the arts, to people in the creative arts and the cultural world generally.
Yeah, there are wonderful stories in there that I think writers of plays, of films and novels are going to find a rich resource.
A rich resource as well of primary sources as well. And that's very important, particularly for people who are looking for a new angle on history, or maybe to dispel myths of history as well.
Yeah. Well, what you get is the social history there, because people are talking about their lives in the very moment that they're living them. So you get much more of a sense of the flavor of it, but also the way that people express themselves. How do they address loved ones? What language do they use? I'm a professor of English, and I find that aspect of the collection extremely interesting, as well as, of course, the social history side of it.
And one notices in it, too, the little formulaic expressions that children used to learn at school. A lot of letters would begin with, "Dear father and mother, I hope this letter finds you in the condition it leaves me in at present."
Yeah.
And that little mantra might be used by a person writing over a period of 10, 20, 30 years as they wrote home to aging parents. So it's very emotional to see that. But as Dan has remarked, particularly in the up until the 19th into the 20th century, when people went to North America, there was the expectation that that was it, that they would never be coming back. And the emotional weight of this material is something that you'd be very conscious of. That doesn't mean that there isn't a concern for simply emotion. There's a concern for hard economics. There's a remark in where somebody had sent home photographs of their kids, and the reply came, "It's nice to get the photographs of your pictures of your kids, but the picture we really want to see is a few of Abraham Lincoln."
Wow.
As in the bills, you know, the dollar bills.
Wow.
So it's so these people predominantly had tough lives. They had hard lives. The life of the emigrant is not an easy life. And they had to find work. They had to get on in a strange, very different country. They're predominantly rural people going to urban industrial America by the latter half of the 19th century. So they were encountering a very, very different rhythm of life than the one with which they had experienced here in Ireland, and most especially perhaps the west of Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose the other side of this as well, you mentioned there that people often, it was a one-way ticket. Sometimes people didn't actually get there for a finish. The coffin ships and that angle of it. They didn't write, but would there have been like family who got there who were expecting people and stuff? Is that covered?
I went to the United States in 1992 to go to university in Pittsburgh, and my mother remarked that I'd be like her uncles who were born in West Donegal, who went to Alaska and never wrote. So certainly you got people who never wrote.
Yeah.
But the majority of people who went got there, and a large number of those who got there did write. And if we want to understand how ordinary people in the past lived the big changes in their time, this material is second to none.
Mm. It is leading up to St. Patrick's weekend now, and I suppose there are a lot of Americans in town. Professor Daniel Carey, as someone from America yourself, what kind of emotional weight does this have on the American psyche?
It's huge. I mean, we saw it last year when President Biden was visiting, and of how much family connections mean to him. That's a very good illustration of it. In my own case, my family would have left during the famine. We don't have any surviving correspondence. So for me, this is as close as I can come to hearing the voice of people that were connected to me. So even when you don't have family letters, this is how they wrote, what they thought, what they experienced. You can go to the particular places where they were working and living. Obviously, there were great enclaves of Irish in Boston and New York and Philadelphia and elsewhere in the country. But you also find people in very distant places. There's a fascinating letter from somebody in Butte, Montana, talking about the loss of the Irish language and what a great lamentable thing this is. Don't know how many Irish speakers there were in Butte, Montana. But it just opens up this door to a past experience, which if your family is connected with it, there's nothing like it.
And because so many of Irish American ancestry went on to do such great things in America as well, the likes of JFK, etc.
Yeah, I think we notice those people. We notice the people who are successful and who achieve prominence. But most immigrants remained working class people, you know, and this is an archive not just of working class people, but working class voices, ordinary working people, people who mined, people who worked in factories, people, women who worked in domestic service. That's what you're getting here. You're getting the voice of people who went for a better life, went to get away from whatever life they had here in many instances, and didn't always get it easy. And it's massively absorbing to read through this material.
Mm. It's called the Imerca Project. Is it live yet, or...?
It is live. It went live on Thursday of last week. We had a wonderful launch on Bonham Dock here in Galway in the Alicantra building. We haven't all the material uploaded yet. We'll be uploading it in tranches. We expect to have all the transcripts of letters and memoirs that Miller collected uploaded by the end of this calendar year. We are already receiving a large volume of material since last Thursday of people contacting us, offering us material. Often they have already scanned it. We'll be able to transcribe it. We'll be able to get it into the web, into the Imerca website. And it's a wonderful connection for us, the university, with the descendants of our emigrants over a very, very long time. So it's a connection across time with the homes that people left behind.
Mm. And I suppose one part of it as well, you mentioned you're looking for people to contribute, and they can contribute on imerca.universityofgalway.ie. Do you find a hesitation with certain topics and with people pulling back and maybe not, or maybe you wouldn't know about it? I'm thinking in my own head, the likes of the Civil War in Ireland in that period, is there a scarcity of information and letters on that?
Well, I think in any family letters, there's going to be some material that you don't want the neighbours to read, you know, and that might be a letter coming from America saying, you know, this is no country for a drunkard, which might be a reference to a younger brother you don't want arriving over to be getting in your way, or this is no country for somebody who isn't fit to work. You know, it's a kind of coded way of saying don't be sending Jimmy or Johnny or Paddy, and you get a lot of that in it. But the material is old, the people are dead. It's important, I think, if we are to fully comprehend, if historians are to fully comprehend the experience of the Irish across North America, I think it's important that people let their stories be archived in this database and available to other people to engage with.
Mm. Has there been much interest since the launch?
Massive, massive. It's a project is located in the library. Marie-Louise Rouget is the digital archivist, and the material is coming in. And as we release more, as the database is deepened by all the material being uploaded and the OCR capacity to search within, the interest will, I think, increase. Like, you'll be able to search for every letter written by a Murphy, every letter received by a Murphy, and every letter that mentions a Murphy. And yeah, you'll be able to search for Carna, Carraro, you name it. Small places, big places. And even if you don't find your own family in it, you will at least find people whose experience was similar to emigrants among your forebears.
Proud day as well for you, Daniel?
Yes, absolutely. No, this project came together really quite rapidly. The gift was given in 2021, as Brendan was saying. And so we're really delighted this partnership with the library and the university through people working in history and English and other fields to come together and to make it available as a resource. There are now 3,000 letters that are available, so there's a substantial amount. And just reading through them is pleasurable, a fascinating glimpse into the past, whether you go decade by decade or look for particular topics that catch your eye.
I think it's a great resource, and I'm delighted to see all that collaboration on it as well. Professor Daniel Carey and Professor Brendan McSivna, thank you for joining us in Galway Talks. And more information on how to contribute to the collection is available at imerca.universityofgalway.ie. That's about it for today's programme. My thanks to Darren Kelly, who helped on the production side of things. Fiona, who took your calls on reception. If you want to get involved in tomorrow and indeed Friday's show, which of course is our Community Matters broadcast from O'Connor's Bar in Salt Hill, do get in contact straight away, comments@goibfm.ie, or the phone numbers as well. Coming up on the programme tomorrow, it's already pretty jam-packed. We have Aoife Riley coming into studio about the latest work with Boher. There's a warning ahead of St. Patrick's weekend in terms of break-ins that comes in from Netwatch. We'll be discussing that. We have the Connacht Tribune headlines. We also have a very special feature. There's a lot of men involved in a special event taking place, a relief work for Palestine, which is taking place this weekend as part of the match in Pearse Stadium. We have David Hickey, the former great Dublin footballer, and many others coming into studio to discuss that. And of course, we will have our Cheltenham review as well, with George McDonough and the team from Boyle Sports on another charity bet. We'll also look at social prescribing, because it's Social Prescribing Day tomorrow. That and much more, including Ars to Protect. In Culture Corner, we look at TG Cahir's teenage drama series, Sail Ella, as they launch the first ever Irish sign language broadcast version of the Irish TV drama. I think it's a very great and worthy initiative as well. As well as that, we have Music Mornings as usual again tomorrow, and this time we're joined by the crew from Green Hills as well. So all that plus lots more tomorrow on the programme. My thanks to everyone involved, and if you do want to get involved, do ring in straight away. Up next is Ronan Lardner with the Livewire. I'm John Morley. From all of us here on Galway Talk, stay safe and have a very good afternoon.